Hello and welcome. This is Inside Education. My name is Sean Delaney. Later on this week's programme, I'll bring you another interview from the BT Young Scientist Competition. We'll hear how students with different learning styles respond to different styles of teaching. I'll also bring you an interview with one of the organisers of the upcoming Computer Education Society of Ireland's 2010 conference in Port Laois. But first, as always, we go to this week's roundup of education news stories brought to us by Barry Hennessy. You're welcome, Barry.
Hello to you again, Sean.
Barry, the Minister O'Keefe managed to surprise us all again this week.
Well, yes, indeed. The main education developments this week have centred on third level, where the Minister for Education and Science, Bat O'Keefe, seems to have caught everyone by surprise by announcing the dissolution of the National University of Ireland. Although the move had been proposed in the report of On Board Snip Nua, it appears that the first the NUI Chancellor Maurice Manning heard about it was at a meeting with Minister O'Keefe just hours before the news was made public. In a subsequent email to members of the NUI's governing Senate, Dr. Manning said Minister O'Keefe had told him the decision to abolish the 102-year-old institution was based on streamlining the qualifications process and not on financial considerations. The NUI currently receives about €3 million annually from Exchequer funds. Now, the NUI's main functions include the validation of study programmes in its 9 constituent colleges and the setting of matriculation requirements for school leavers. So what are the implications of dissolving the NUI for prospective future students, many of whom are currently completing their CAO forms? Michael Gleeson is PRO of the Institute of Guidance Counsellors.
Well, from my experience, having spoken to students, and I'm talking here potential students, there is some concern among students because the NUI has an excellent brand label and it has a certain international recognition. And a number of students, when they would come looking for advice, what course to go to, where should they go, what does one university distinguishes itself from another, they often go by the brand name of the National University of Ireland. However, I'm sure the quality of the actual degree is as good and will continue to be as good as it always has been.
Michael, let's talk about something that certainly has been getting some publicity during the week, and it's the whole issue of entry requirements. There have been some suggestions that, free to make their own decisions, the colleges might relax one of the traditional requirements, which is around languages, and in particular the need to present both Irish and a foreign language if you are an Irish citizen. Do you think that's a likely outcome of this decision?
Well, currently, as it actually stands, a number of the science and engineering courses within the National University of Ireland do not require languages for those particular subject areas. But then there are other universities that do not, such as the University of Limerick, which does not require a foreign language as an entry requirement. Now, the long-term picture, in my own opinion, is that a number of students at the moment who are just completing their junior cert, these students will, in the next few weeks, will be deciding what subjects to choose at second level in terms of going on to study for senior cycle for the Leaving Cert. And these students will need to know relatively soon whether or not they will require languages, because the management in the schools will have to select their resources and for the academic year for the next 2 years in terms of providing necessary subjects that students need. What I would be saying is that there needs to be further consultation, because this decision was very rash and very abrupt, and I'm not so sure as to how wide-scale the consultation process was between the Department of Education and all the players in the education field.
Guidance Councillor Michael Gleeson there. Well, at the same time as Minister O'Keefe was announcing the dissolution of one of the most recognised brands in Irish education, representatives of all 7 Irish universities were in the US this week for the launch of the Irish Universities Connecting Continents initiative. Irish universities have already established partnerships with renowned US colleges, including Cornell, Yale, Harvard and Stanford. Two showcase events in New York and Washington this week had the dual objective of promoting further research partnerships between Ireland and the US and attracting greater numbers of American students to study at universities here. In 2007-2008, 6,800 American students selected Ireland as a study abroad destination, a 20% increase from the previous year. In addition, it's estimated that about 1,000 US students are studying full-time in Irish universities. The bulk of American students coming to Ireland for full-time or temporary study are studying arts and humanities, but the government and the universities are anxious to increase transatlantic links in science, engineering and other related disciplines. Now, if the former EU Commissioner Peter Sutherland is to be believed, they'll have their work cut out for them in a country where only one university is ranked in the top 100 internationally. Speaking at the Royal Irish Academy on Friday, Mr Sutherland, who's now chairman of the London School of Economics and investment bank Goldman Sachs, said the number of universities in Ireland would have to be reduced if world-class research was to be sustained. TCD and UCD could be amalgamated, Mr Sutherland argued, to create one of the world's top 10 institutions. In a wide-ranging and controversial address, the former EU Commissioner called for greater flexibility in dismissing underperforming academics and the return of third-level fees. He also criticised government moves to reduce the pay of university presidents and senior academics and renewed his call for poor teachers in schools to be dismissed more easily. However, Mr Sutherland's contention that it's virtually impossible to sack anyone in an Irish school might ring particularly hollow to the hundreds of teachers who lost their jobs last summer owing to the increased pupil-teacher ratio. And that's this week's News Roundup, Sean.
Thanks very much, Barry. And Barry Hennessy will be back at the same time next week with more education news. You're listening to 103.2 Dublin City FM. You can get in touch with the programme by texting 086 8962 665. That is 086 8962 665 for your texts. The 46th BT Young Scientists and Technology Exhibition took place recently at the RDS in Dublin, and I brought you interviews from there last week. This week, I bring you an interview with three students from Carrick-on-Shannon Community School, James Dolan, Brendan Jordan and Connor Kniff. Their study was titled A Study of Different Approaches to Education, Including Visual, Auditory and Kinesthetic. When I spoke to them, I began by asking them why they were interested in this topic. James was the first to respond.
Well, I have an interest in education myself. I did work experience at a local primary school, so I thought it'd be interesting to do an experiment on teaching methods.
Okay, so can you just describe the difference between visual, auditory and kinesthetic teaching methods, Brendan?
Well, visual is the method of learning through seeing images and pictures, while kinesthetic will be more interacting, like physical activities, and finally is the auditory one, which will be more listening, the ear of the learning.
Okay, so would I be right in thinking that most learning traditionally has been auditory? Would that be right, Connor?
Yeah, yes it is, but in our school, luckily, we have a projector in each room, so in our school, visual has taken a huge advance, because we're lucky enough to have that there. But traditionally, in most schools, it would be auditory.
So this is changing because of technology, you're saying?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so what did you want to investigate as part of this study, James?
We wanted to see which method was most effective out of the three, visual, auditory and kinesthetic. And we also wanted to see what learning styles the students had themselves, whether they were visual, auditory or kinesthetic learners.
Okay, so how did you go about studying that, Brendan?
Well, we made up a fictional country, Rindau, and we handed out tests and on...
What did you call the fictional country?
Rindau. We placed it in Southeast Asia and we tested a few first years in our school on the... We gave them out information on it, and then afterwards we gave them out tests and we corrected the tests and see how well they did in it.
So you became teachers yourselves, is that right?
Well, we the only class we really got to teach through was kinesthetic, because to make it fair on the students, we got a school teacher from our own school to give out the lessons in auditory and visual. That way, giving them a fair chance, because we wouldn't have been really good for giving it out, you know.
Oh, because you wanted people who had some teaching skills in the first place.
With kinesthetic, there wasn't really a teacher at school who had done that sort of thing, and it was basically, we just gave them a play. We created our own play with a script and stuff, so we just handed it out to them and let them go with it.
So did you use the three different methods with the same group of students each time?
No, what we did was we had three separate groups of 20 students in each group. And one group we taught them visually and using images and videos. And then the second group was kinesthetic, which was acting out a play. and the third group is auditory, which was an oral lecture. And for all the groups, the content was the same, but the medium through which we taught it was different.
And who planned these lessons, Brendan?
It was a group effort overall.
So the three of you planned them?
Yeah, we took a few days before we set into the actual experiments. We sat down and decided to write the material, the tests, ways of correcting, etc., that kind of thing.
And did you get any advice or any assistance in planning the lessons, Connor?
Not in the actual lessons ourselves, but we before we gave out the actual tests, we did a smaller practice test on the other students in transition year to see what was going through. Did it work out? Do we have time limits? That kind of thing. And just basically got rid of any errors that could have happened during the initial actual test.
Okay, so how did you test then how well the different groups of students had learned, James?
Gave them the lesson, and then we gave them out a very short test that they had 10 minutes to fill out. And the test was the same for the three classes, as was the content, so it was easier to compare the results then of the three groups.
Okay, and what did you find, James? Sorry, Brendan.
Yeah, and we found out that visual overall would be the best method of learning, because, as I said before, about the projectors in each class. And
those students did better after the lesson?
Yeah, we believe they did. And but in the case of kinesthetic, we found that if you're a kinesthetic learner, you'd do better in the kinesthetic class.
Can you just explain that? Why you do better in a kinesthetic class? Why is that?
Like if you are that type of learner, the one to interact kind of physical, you'd learn better by through plays and interacting with the teachers and such like that. Like.
So how did you find out about what kind of learners the students were?
Well, about a week before we got the test, we went out to each classroom and handed out questionnaires with which they answered a question. There was multiple choice with three answers to each question. One answer indicated oratory, one indicated visual, the other indicated kinesthetic. And then once we had found out which kind of learner each student was, after the test we compared, did visual learners do better in a visual class, or did like visual better learners do better in an oratory class, and compare them, see was there any connection, if any at all.
And what did you find then? So how did visual learners, for example, do in the visual class, first of all, James?
Well, we found that the visual learners, whether they were in a visual or auditory class, they didn't do much different. We found that overall, there was no link between their own learning style and the teaching method of the class, and except for kinesthetic, where we found if they weren't in a kinesthetic class, they would actually do worse as a result.
So kinesthetic learners suffer most if they're in a class that's mostly auditory or mostly visual?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so that's an interesting lesson for teachers to be aware of, Brendan.
Yeah, well, hopefully it'll be put into practice soon anyways.
Okay, so have you shared your results with any teachers yet?
Mainly only our career guidance teacher and the teachers which took part in the experiment as in, who read out the tests and gave up their classes.
So what would your advice be then to teachers who are thinking of planning lessons for different kinds of learners in their classes, James?
To bring a visual side to the classroom, use images, videos to get the message across as well. Have posters up in that classroom which relate to the subject being taught. And to also, when students enter the school, to have a learning style questionnaire given out to them so that if it is found that they are kinesthetic learners, special arrangements can be made that they're put into a class which will allow them to learn best kinesthetically.
And where can teachers get a survey to study the learning styles in their class?
There's multiple places online, FARC and Dun and Dun. These are methods that we've looked up ourselves, and there's surveys there. And you can also make up your own if you have the time and methods of doing so.
Okay, and do you have plans to take this study any further, Connor?
Well, so far we're mainly just concentrating all our energy on this Young Scientist project, but afterwards, if we feel that we could go further, we definitely would.
And do you have any thoughts on where you might go next with it, James?
There's a lot of talk in psychology about the male and female aspects of learning. Do they react differently to different kinds of learning? So if we were to take this project further, we would focus on that. Did males and females do different in the classes?
Are you in an all-boys school at the moment?
No, we're in a mixed school.
So this study was conducted with boys and girls?
It was. It was conducted with a mix, but there was no special focus on the mix of boys and girls.
And do any of you plan to be teachers yourselves or scientists yourselves in the future? James first.
I have done work experience as a teacher, and I'm also interested in science, so perhaps a science teacher.
Sounds like a good combination. What about you, Brendan?
Not particularly, no. More the media aspect of things I'd go for myself.
And what about Connor?
Obviously, I have an interest in it, but I wouldn't follow it out his career.
Okay.
Guys, thanks very much, and best of luck with the competition.
No problem. Thanks.
And James, Brendan and Connor were highly commended for their project in the Social and Behavioural Sciences Intermediate section at the BT Young Scientists exhibition. Well done to them. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. You can follow us on Twitter at Inside Ed. A conference that takes place shortly is that of the Computer Education Society of Ireland. To tell me more about it, I am joined now by the co-chair of the society, Adrienne Webb. Adrienne has been teaching in a secondary school for many years and is the ICT coordinator in her school. You're welcome to Inside Education, Adrienne.
Thank you very much, Sean. Delighted to be here.
Adrienne, can you tell me a little bit more about the Computer Education Society of Ireland? What exactly does it do?
Well, the Computer Education Society of Ireland was actually founded in 1973, which in terms of technology was fairly early on. And it was by teachers who saw this new development and thought, maybe this will have something to offer education. But as we know, it took many, many years then for technology to move into mainstream. And in the middle 80s, people began teaching a lot of programming, and BASIC and COMAL was the programming language that the department was promoting at the time. So you had a small group of very interested teachers. At that stage, I would have to say many of them were maths teachers and sciences, because it kind of fitted into a module that they were allowed to in the maths, certainly in the second level. Now, as PCs and that became more and more part of our lives, the opportunities for education and using technology increased. So the people that are involved in SESI could see the potential, and SESI became a kind of a forum for people not just from, say, second level, but first and third level. And we're fairly unique in that we actually cover all three levels of education. So we have many different perspectives. We have people who are very involved in the techie side, as one would say, and those who are more focused on the actual use of them. And there's a great complementarity between that, because the techies help us see how we can use it, fix it and keep it going in the classroom. And then those who are very focused on the pedagogy enable a more wide approach to how that technology is used within the classroom. So it's a real melting pot, I think would be the best way to put it, of various interests.
And when you say that some of the teachers are interested in how technology is used in the classroom, can you give us some examples of how you've seen or how you've heard about technology being used in the classroom?
Well, very simply, I would have to say that one of the things that I saw that had the greatest impact, say, in the mid-90s, was the actual digital camera. A very small piece of kit, not terribly expensive, but it really had a massive influence, particularly in the primary schools, where primary school teachers are now able to photograph their students' work, put it up on the web. And we all know that in the primary school, the visual aspect is very, very strong, and being able to display work, it allowed multiple copies of things being sent out. And I remember thinking at the time that that had a tremendous impact for a very small piece of technology. And I think in a similar way, the interactive whiteboard over the last 2 or 3 years, the teachers are running with it. The schools are running with the concept because they can see the potential. It's not coming from the department. It's not coming from a university department that says we have to do it. But the possibilities of that it has for the classroom are enormous, but it's been noticed by the teachers. So that teaching changes, it's enhanced, it's added to. You just had an item there about the different types of learners, about the kinesthetic learners and the visual and audio learners. And I think that technology offers that wider variety that just the classroom board and pen and chalk certainly hasn't in the past. And it brings that in a very, very big way.
And to what extent is technology actually changing what's happening in schools, or, you know, is it having the impact on schools that it potentially could have, do you think?
Oh, I think it would have much bigger impact than it's having at the moment. But I think what we can't overlook is that you must bring the teachers and the technology along together. And that if you drop a whole lot of technology into a school but haven't got it as an integrated plan and part of a vision for how the learning is going to take place, then it will, as it has done in the past, gather dust. I think it's the teacher bringing their specialist knowledge of pedagogy and how learning operates, those who are familiar with the technologies and what it has to offer, and it's the blend of the two together that just change learning styles. One of the interesting things that I think it also changes the power structure within a classroom, and this can have its problems for individuals. The teachers are used to maybe being at the top of the room, directing absolutely everything, and if changes are to take place, they emanate from the teacher. If you introduce technologies and students using technologies in the classroom, you change that, and students themselves have a higher input into what goes on. And that can be difficult for people to change to. It can be slow. And what I'm a secondary school teacher myself, so my observations in many instances are quite personal. But what I have seen, the people I've spoken to, that the primary school classroom, through the nature of the day, the single teacher being in control of what happens, has a much higher potential to introduce those technologies in a multiplicity of ways without them being the only way that teaching and learning happens in the classroom.
And I suppose another factor at primary school is that the teachers, because the children are younger, the teachers would probably have less of a risk of losing face if something goes wrong with the technology in the classroom.
I think you probably have a point there. I think when we move on to the secondary school, there is an element of losing face and the teacher having to know everything. I think possibly, and as I said, I'm speaking as an outsider in a way looking in, that there is more a learning together approach in many of the curriculums within the primary school, whereas there is, sad to say, a dominance of the education of the examinations culture within second level. So the teacher gives out, the student absorbs, we all do the exam, we all go home happy, hopefully.
And obviously the CESI is one of the organisations that can influence change in the classroom and in terms of how technology is used. What kind of activities, apart from the conference which we'll discuss in a moment, but what kind of activities does the organisation offer around the year, you know, year round?
Yeah, well, needless to say, as technologies have changed, so we have changed in how we deliver things, and we have had a branch structure in the past where local organisers would see what local needs were in terms of technology, and using the education system network or the education centre network would deliver that. Now, because in current days so many of us are time poor, and yet we do sit down at our computers, increasingly we're using the technology that we are talking about to assist us to keep in touch. So one of the big things is the SESI list, and that's a mailing list which at this stage is nearly 500 members on it, and the conversations that are going on are extremely diverse. People finding assistance, people simply saying, oh, I saw this, thought it was really cool, maybe you'd like to have a look at it. And it's a great way for information exchange. So in conjunction with that, then, we have the SESI website. And on that website, we have a regular feature called the DigiTeach article. And it really is a platform for anybody who has an interest in education to say what they feel, maybe about something they've been doing, maybe use it as a soapbox, and then just share ideas. And certainly for me as a classroom teacher, it's the way I find out what's going on, because I don't necessarily have time to buy a whole lot of magazines and read them. I seem to be on the go all the time. I know I can click in. There's also an archive of the various articles. We also have reports from our conferences going back a good number of years too, so you can see the various developments. The other thing that we've had and are introducing at the moment is a thing called a SESI Meet. We're about to have our third one, but we had one there in September in the Digital Hub. And the concept is that you have a session set aside that has kind of a semi-informal tone to it. You have 2-minute presentations, which you on radio are well aware of the importance of time, but perhaps those of us in the classroom, 2 minutes is challenging. 5-minute presentations and 15-minute. And I think one of the aspects of it is you do not know in advance what the presentations are. So it's like opening that Christmas present under the tree, hoping it'll have what you want, but not really too sure till you attend.
And this is at the conference those different presentations are held, right?
We know we had the one in the Digital Hub as an isolated event, and what we'd like to see in the coming year or so is that more of those occur around the country. It started off, we had our first one as part of last year's conference. We will have one as part of the current conference, but they're an ideal standalone event as well if somebody's interested in doing it. And in fact, the idea comes from the BET conference in London. They have teach meets, okay. So we have our SESI meets.
Yeah, because I really liked going into your website and seeing some of the old magazines that the organisation used to bring out in the early 90s. And I mean, like, it's a historical document now to see how the use of technology in education has changed.
Well, absolutely. And sometimes we can be attached to what we're used to doing. So it took us a little bit of courage and time to actually say, no, we're an organisation interested in technology, therefore we should be using it more. So that even now at our executive meetings, because we're a national organisation, we have members from around the country, we are using the flash meeting to actually have people sit, talk to us from whether it's Kerry or Galway or Cavan and participate in our executive meetings. So distance is not an issue.
Adrian, you're here to tell us about the annual conference. First of all, what is the purpose of it?
Well, despite all this technology, it is wonderful to do face-to-face. And no matter how much you talk on the internet, there's certainly you can't beat meeting that person and seeing how they operate and getting to know them on a personal level. So the purpose of the conference historically has been to bring people together to, in one place over a short period of time, allow a showcase so that we can see what's going on in schools, what's the latest thing that's happening. In fact, one of the problems with the conference and has been over the years is the wealth of riches that we're confronted with. So we have concurrently running sessions, and your biggest problem is, oh my gosh, I want to go to them all. How am I going to pick one of them out of it? So the conference is usually divided up into a series of workshops and presentations. So this year we've 23 presentations and 6 workshops, and that's running from 9 o'clock in the morning till 4:30. So you can imagine a fairly busy day.
And when is it?
It's on the 5th and 6th of February this year. And for the first time in quite a long number of years, we're moving outside Dublin. We're having it in Portlaoise. And on the Friday night, it's in the Heritage Hotel, which is the SETI meet. I did stress the kind of semi-formal or informal nature of this. Yeah. So we do want to encourage people to relax and enjoy themselves. And then it's in Portlaoise Community College on the Saturday.
And why did you move it to Portlaoise this year? Because I understand that every year up to now, it's been held in Dublin. Is that right?
More or less, but I have to say in the early years and other years, it did move outside Dublin. In fact, its start was outside Dublin. It is a national organisation, and we're very aware that people don't particularly like to travel to Dublin and confront all the traffic, which is a big headache. We also want to make it more accessible for people who feel that Dublin is too far from where they're located. So this is the first move to see how it works. Portlaoise is fairly well centred. It's on train lines. We're thinking of the green environment and all the rest as well. And we'll see how we get on. But definitely we want to, it's very important to us that people see it as a national and not just Dublin based organisation.
And who can attend the conference, Adrian?
The whole world.
You're not selective.
Anybody who has any sort of interest in education, whether they're first, second or third level, whether they're retired individuals who still have an ongoing interest, or whatever their aspect might be, that's the only criteria really. The registration for it is done through our website, www.cesi.ie. You can pay online, register online. The costs involved are, if you want to attend the Friday night only, it's €20. Saturday is €30, but that includes your meal, so you're well looked after. And if you manage to and can do both, then it's a €40 charge.
So the website address then for anyone who wants to get involved or wants to go along, it's www.cesi.ie.
That's correct. Yes, indeed. And in fact, if you go into that, you'll find the full programme and you'll find links to short details of what all the presentations and workshops will be about.
Adrian, thanks very much for coming in to talk to us this evening.
Not at all. It's been a pleasure.
Good luck with the conference.
Thank you very much.
And that's all we have time for on this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on www.insideed.com. That is INSIDEED.com. You can contact the programme with comments and suggestions at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That is insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to our studio guest, AGN Webb, and to Barry Hennessy for the education news. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney, signing off. Thank you for listening.